Our next panel is going to be a Supreme Court roundup, and we've had, you know, a very quiet term, so I'm sure there's not going to be a lot to talk about. But I'd like to thank our moderator for this panel, one of South Florida's finest, Judge Rog Singal. He is a district judge for the Southern District of Florida. Before being appointed to the federal bench in 2019, he served as a circuit judge in Broward County. In his time before becoming a judge, he worked in civil litigation and ran a criminal defense practice for many years. He has so many bar associations and community involvements that it would take up the entire panel time for me to read them. So I'll just say thank you for being here today, Judge, and I'll hand it off to you.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me, and it's such a wonderful turnout. I'm glad we're here at the Biltmore, and it's really an honor to be here and to be able to, I guess, moderate this panel with Henry Whitaker and with Zach Smith. The beauty of being a moderator is I learn a whole lot, and so basically I just have to do the introductions and then just turn and listen, and so it's really ideal. I do want to actually introduce both Henry and Zach, and I'm going to introduce Judd Stone, who is not here, just so you know what you're missing. Judd got caught up doing some major work out in Texas, and he feels really badly that he couldn't be here. I think he wanted to be here more than being in Texas, and so it's kind of sad for him there. But let's begin with Henry Whitaker, who is the Florida Solicitor General. Prior to that, was Principal Deputy Assistant Attorney General at the Office of Legal Counsel in the U.S. Department of Justice. He has been an appellate lawyer. He has clerked for Justice Clarence Thomas. At that time, he actually clerked with my good friend Martha Packold, who sits in Chicago as a district court judge and was on the last group of individuals to be considered for U.S. Supreme Court, actually. Henry also clerked for Judge David Sentell of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit. He graduated from Harvard Law School and, as he calls it, Yale College. At least according to his wiki page, he's argued more than 40 times in front of federal appellate courts. I bet that number is a bit higher now.
More than 40 is still right.
But it's really an honor and a pleasure to have Henry here and to be able to hear his views on the Supreme Court term.
Not everything on the Wikipedia page is right, so I don't know who did that.
Well, that's why I said according to the wiki page.
Somebody with incomplete information.
I always look and see when it's edited, and I want to see if it's your initials down there, but it wasn't. So. Zach Smith and I have had an opportunity to do this type of talk before. Last year, in fact, last July, the Dobbs and Bruin term, we did it, and it was, again, very easy for me. I just turned and looked at Zach and let him talk for an hour, and it was a very well-received talk, so it was great. Zach is with the Heritage Foundation. He is a legal fellow and manager of the Supreme Court and Appellate Advocacy Program there. He previously was an Assistant United States Attorney in the Northern District of Florida. For those of you who work in the Southern District of Florida, he worked with Jimmy Ustinovsky, who is one of our favorite prosecutors in that office. Prior to that, he spent 2 years as an associate in D.C. at Cleary Gottlieb, and then he previously had clerked for Judge Emmett Cox on the United States Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit. He received his degrees at University of Florida, so you're a triple gator here. Not much applause for
I know. Gator. Go Gators.
Then he was editor-in-chief of the Florida Law Review. He's been pretty active supporting us through our talks here. Many of you have been to the Supreme Court roundups that we've done with Miguel Estrada. Those typically are kind of like rocket docket talks where Miguel's able to give each case about 45 seconds and go through 70 cases in an hour. Instead, we're going to go through four, five, six cases and really give them a little bit more in-depth treatment here today. We're going to talk probably about the cases that you would expect us to talk about. But we're also going to talk about a few other less significant cases. I did want to mention that Judge Stone, who is the Texas Solicitor General, who's not here for some very important work reasons, just to give you an example of his schedule, in the last 20 months, he's argued in D.C. in front of the U.S. Supreme Court 8 times. So he's pretty active there. What I also wanted to tell you is that we do anticipate having the Miguel Estrada talk down here in October. Also, if any of you are in South Florida and available, September 8th, the Southern District of Florida has a bench bar conference. That might be really worth it for some of you to go to. Miguel Estrada will be there as well, giving a Supreme Court roundup, and he'll be doing it with Neil Katyal, so that'll be almost like a FedSoc-style debate. And I think you all know Neil Katyal just recently won the Moore versus Harper case, so it'll be a pretty interesting interesting talk there. So I guess what I'd like to do, Zach, let me have you take it away with the affirmative action case first. I think you all are well aware that involved a private institution, Harvard, and a public university, University of North Carolina. It dealt with race-based admissions. Many of you probably also noticed that within an hour of the opinion, somehow all these journalists knew exactly what the opinion said and what you should know about it, even though it was 237 pages long, and I was only on page 10 after an hour, but they had been able to read it, digest it, and write long articles that had headlines and the complete holding of the cases. So probably following New York Times versus Sullivan, that's a good way to start off. And have you take it away on affirmative action.
Well, we're starting with nothing controversial, so I'm glad to see that. But thank you all for letting me be here today to talk. I'm really happy to be here, and I'm happy to serve as the riffraff on the panel between the judge and Henry to talk about some of these cases. But the Harvard and UNC cases, obviously these are ones we've all heard about. As the judge mentioned, it's received a lot of media coverage. And even though they came out as one opinion, these are actually two separate cases. A group called Students for Fair Admissions brought lawsuits against both Harvard and UNC all the way back in 2014. These were brought by Will Consovoy, Tom McCarthy, and other lawyers working in their firm. And so this litigation has literally been going on for almost a decade at this point. And essentially, what Students for Fair Admissions alleged was that the admissions policies and practice of Harvard and UNC violated two provisions, the Equal Protection Clause of the Constitution and Title VI of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. Now, that's important because, obviously, the University of North Carolina is a public school. Harvard is a private school. And so while the Constitution would apply directly to University of North Carolina, Title VI would be applicable to Harvard and other federal grant-receiving colleges and universities and institutions of higher education. But as we'll talk about in a minute, that distinction matters less than it might seem like at first glance because of the way the court has interpreted the Equal Protection Clause and Title VI. They've interpreted it where they're essentially interchangeable in some sense. If there's a violation of the Equal Protection Clause, there's going to be a violation of Title VI as well. And so these cases made their way up to the U.S. Supreme Court. It turned out these were 6-2, 6-3 decisions, and the reason the numbers were slightly different is because Justice Jackson was recused from the Harvard case. She still participated in the UNC case, but because of her role on the Board of Overseers of Harvard University, she didn't participate in the Harvard case. Now, the Chief Justice, he wrote the majority opinion, and he did a good job laying out the case as it had developed through the lower courts, laying out the allegations that Students for Fair mission brought. And essentially, he found appropriately that the practices of Harvard and UNC, they did violate the Equal Protection Clause and Title VI as well. And the reason they did that is because if we go back several decades in the court's history, there are two prior decisions dealing with affirmative action in higher education that really have dominated this area. The Bakke decision, where it's a very splintered decision of the court. Justice Powell wrote only for himself, but his opinion was viewed for many years as kind of the determinative opinion in that area. And then Grutter versus Bollinger, which came out in 2003, where the court formally adopted what Justice Powell had said in his earlier opinion in many ways. And so what the court said in Grutter is that universities could consider an applicant's race in their admissions decisions, but they could only do so as a plus factor. It couldn't be the determinative factor. And they laid out a series of factors and tests universities would essentially have to look at. And they basically said as well, this is what Justice O'Connor said in her opinion in Grutter, is that she suspected there would come a day when race would no longer have to be considered at all in making admissions decisions in higher education. And she put a time frame of 25 years on that. And we're bumping up against that 25-year time frame today. Well, what Justice Roberts did, Chief Justice Roberts, in his opinion, he went through the practices of UNC and Harvard and showed that in most cases, while Harvard and UNC were supposedly considering a variety of factors, things like academics, personal statements, extracurricular activities, along with an applicant's race, the way this worked in reality was that often race was the determinative factor. And so you would have someone who scored much, much lower on nearly every other category, but would receive a significant boost solely because of his or her race that would then lead them to being admitted over other applicants who scored much, much higher in every other category across the board. And so the Chief Justice laid out, he said, whenever race is used in making admissions decisions or in really any area of governmental action, the court needs to apply strict scrutiny, which we all know means there needs to be a compelling government interest, and the action the government takes needs to be narrowly tailored to achieve that interest. And so the Chief Justice said, he said, there are really only two reasons the court has ever said that race can be considered a compelling government interest whenever it takes actions based on someone's race. He said those two compelling interests are to remedy specific past instances of discrimination. So if you have a particular instance with a particular individual and the government wants to remedy that, that can be a compelling governmental interest. And he also said a compelling governmental interest could be for the government to protect life and limb. And the example he gave in the opinion was prison race riots, for instance. It would be appropriate in some instances for prison officials to potentially separate inmates by race temporarily to avoid deadly consequences to other inmates and staff. He said outside of those two limited instances, the court has never recognized a compelling government interest in treating people differently because of their race. And as importantly, he also said that even if you assume the universities did set forward a compelling governmental interest in treating different applicants differently because of their race, certainly their policies weren't narrowly tailored to achieve those goals. And so that was really where the bulk of his opinion focused. One interesting footnote that he had in the opinion, footnote 4, talked about military academies. There was a carve-out for military academies. This was at the urging of the United States, a filing they made in their amicus brief, where they said there were different circumstances, different government interests at play for the military and service academies in particular. And so the Chief Justice said in his footnote that this opinion didn't address the context of military academies, so we could see future litigation on that particular topic. A lot of commentators have said that carve-out doesn't necessarily make sense in light of the larger rationale of these opinions, but we'll have to wait to see how they play out ultimately. Then there were several concurring opinions as well. Justice Thomas wrote a very lengthy concurring opinion, a very good concurring opinion, I think. I commend it to everyone, where he basically defended the idea of a colorblind constitution. He went back, went through the original history behind the passage of the 14th Amendment, behind a lot of the actions and previous court cases the government has taken, and really kind of put to rest this idea that there could be such a thing as benign or good discrimination in the form of affirmative action. So it's a very good opinion. Justice Gorsuch also wrote a separate concurrence where he talked about why the university's actions would also be a violation of Title VI. He seemed to take some issue with the court's treatment of Title VI and the Equal Protection Clause as being essentially interchangeable from a legal analysis perspective. So we'll have to wait to see if he writes more about that in future cases. Justice Kavanaugh also concurred in this case, and he concurred to emphasize two things, really. One, that the court's decision in the Harvard and UNC cases, while they may have, for all practical purposes, overruled Grutter and Bakke in the previous affirmative action cases of the court, they didn't do so formally. And in his view, the court's opinion in these cases really were just a continuation of those earlier cases, and he kind of laid out why he thought that was so. Then, of course, Justice Sotomayor, she wrote the principal dissent. Justice Jackson also wrote a dissent. There were some sharp words between the dissenting opinions, some sharp words from Chief Justice Roberts and the majority back at the dissenters. There was one interesting quote, I thought, from the chief's opinion, because in the majority, they said applicants could still discuss their race, they could still discuss their own life experiences in their application essays. Race just couldn't be the determinative factor. And so Justice Sotomayor seemed to suggest universities may have a lot of wiggle room to essentially use those personal statements, other applicant statements, to kind of more or less get around the court's decisions in these cases. And so the Chief Justice said, and I quote, "A dissenting opinion is generally not the best source of legal advice on how to comply with a majority opinion." So I thought that was an interesting back and forth. And then one of the other quotes from Justice Jackson's dissenting opinion that's received a lot of media coverage. There's actually a Wall Street Journal op-ed a couple of weeks ago talking about it. Is she cited a statistic that presented in one of the amicus briefs. The Association of American Medical Colleges, they made a claim that for high-risk black newborns, having a black physician more than doubles the likelihood that the baby will live. Now, that sounds like a shocking statistic. Ted Frank, he did a lengthy tweet thread on this. He wrote the Wall Street Journal op-ed explaining why that is statistically and mathematically impossible, given current infant mortality rates, to have a survival rate that more than doubles. But more interestingly, he also looked at the study that the amicus brief cited, and it turns out the study doesn't actually say that. And so Justice Jackson took a lot of criticism for including that quote in her opinion. And in fact, it received so much attention that the authors of that amicus brief actually took the extremely unusual step of filing a letter with the clerk of the Supreme Court clarifying what the study actually said, what they actually meant to say in their amicus brief, and why, in their view, the overall claims are still correct, even though this particular statistic might not have been correct. The two other things I'll quickly flag for everyone is, it'll be interesting to see how lower courts apply this opinion going forward. There was a recent opinion out of Tennessee, a district court in Tennessee, where the court there struck down the SBA's, some of their programming designed to benefit minority business owners. They cited the Harvard and UNC cases as part of their rationale for that case. And then there's also another case coming out of the Fourth Circuit. I suspect a cert petition will be filed shortly involving Thomas Jefferson High School in Fairfax County, Virginia. That's a very competitive magnet school, high school in Fairfax County. It has traditionally been based solely on an applicant's merits, but in the past few years, they changed the formulation for how students can apply. They've given much more weight to race. As a result, Asian American students have seen their admittance numbers plummet dramatically. And so a group, the Coalition for Thomas Jefferson High School, filed a lawsuit. They lost in the lower federal courts, but I suspect in light of the Harvard and UNC cases, they'll probably file a cert petition relatively soon asking the court to review how these decisions apply in the context of elementary and other public school type education.
I would certainly recommend that you take a look at that Ted Frank op-ed in the Wall Street Journal. And for those of you who have read that I have called Ted Frank a vexatious whiner. It was in a different context, so please don't hold that against me. With regard to the opinions, though, Zach, any surprises? I mean, did it go pretty much the way that you expected?
I think so. You know, I think there was some concern initially, you know, whether the Chief Justice, how he would write the opinion, whether Justice Kavanaugh would go along with him. But I think this was a good opinion. Certainly, I think it reached, from my perspective, the correct result in these cases. The only surprise, if you can say that, and maybe this can be part of a larger conversation we talk about as well, was, again, some of the very pointed language that the justices used against each other. Not only did you have the Chief Justice kind of taking that barb at Justice Sotomayor in her dissenting opinion, Justice Thomas in his concurring opinion at length really rebutted directly many of the claims that Justice Jackson made in her opinion, often calling out Justice Jackson by name, talking about why her claims in her dissent not only were wrong, but also very misplaced from a legal and social perspective as well. So I think the very pointed language, not necessarily a surprise, but certainly something I think we saw a little bit more of this term than we have in previous terms.
Henry, any thoughts, anything you wanted to add with regard to that particular case?
Sure, yeah. First of all, 237 pages. 237 pages, one case. I mean, the court is taking a record low number of cases. How many circuit splits that they've denied cert in could they have resolved in the time that it took to write concurrence after concurrence, dissent after dissent in this case? So it's an interesting, I think, reflection on how the court wants to spend its time. And maybe the court has too much time on its hands. I don't know. It's interesting to think about whether that case, and it's an important case, but it's a lot of pages to devote to one case when there are a lot of cases where cert is getting denied, that the lower courts are kind of at sea on certain issues. So I thought that was an interesting aspect of the case. I thought the way that the chief wrote the opinion is interesting. As Zach mentioned, the chief studiously avoids purporting to overrule any particular case, even though the inference is unmistakable that he is engaging in a kind of analysis that does depart from prior precedent in many, many respects. And it's interesting that the chief thinks that that is a better way to go about things than just being a little bit more straightforward and saying what the court is really doing, because it's going to put us in a position, I think, when the opinion could be read broadly or narrowly. It could be read to be a relatively narrow decision about this particular case and the particular interests that were asserted, maybe even limited to higher education, let's say, or it could be treated more broadly as a broader statement about how we treat racial classifications and how strictly racial classifications need to be scrutinized in our country before they may be used by the government. And I think it's unfortunate because I think that it leaves a lot of room and really limits, despite the 237 pages, about how much this opinion really resolves. I mean, you know, Zach mentioned Justice Kavanaugh's concurrence, where he wants to view the court's opinion as more of a continuation of prior law. Then you have Justice Thomas's dissent, where he says that the court has effectively overruled precedent. And so we don't really know what the court's opinion means ultimately. And I guess I'd contrast that approach with Justice Thomas' opinions last term in Bruin, which is very straightforward in saying, no balancing, no thank you. We are adopting a clear test, and it'll be interesting to see which of those two approaches is something that truly gives guidance to the lower court. Not that Bruin resolved Bruin, that Bruin was the case about New York's law generally prohibiting, as a presumptive matter, people from carrying guns outside their home. And Justice Thomas adopts what I think it's fair to say is more of a bright line test for, in his opinion, for the court. And the contrast between those two approaches is, I think, interesting. I also think that there are certain aspects of the chief's analysis in applying strict scrutiny that are quite interesting. One of the things that the Chief Justice stresses is that in analyzing the interests that a state is asserting. You have to, they have to be amenable to, they have to be something that judges can actually weigh and balance. They have to be in the generalized interests in creating future leaders is not something that is easily amenable to judicial judgment. And I thought that was an interesting aspect of things, and we'll talk about, I think, balancing more in the way the court has treated balancing in other cases as we go on in the panel.
The other thing I'd quickly say, if I can, the other thing that I thought was very interesting about this, you know, we talk a lot about amicus briefs, what are in the amicus briefs. These cases had over 100 amicus briefs filed in them, which is a lot for cases. You know, we've heard a lot about very high-profile cases over the past few terms that have had a number of amicus briefs filed, but these in particular really saw a flood of amicus briefs being filed from a number of divergent viewpoints, which, as we saw with Justice Jackson, can sometimes get you in trouble if you don't kind of fact-check what's in those briefs.
If you all do have an opportunity to read Justice Thomas's opinion in these cases, and then if you really want to get an idea of you know, kind of where he was coming from and what may have informed his thought process, and if you ever get out to Savannah, I would highly recommend that you visit where he grew up. It's a little area called Pinpoint, just outside Savannah, and it's just remarkable to see how an individual could grow up there and end up on the United States Supreme Court. And it really gives you an idea as well in terms of where he's coming from on these cases. So, all right, let's switch gears. Henry, I'll call on you up first on this on 303 Creative. So we're gonna go to Colorado and deal with a law that they have out there and whether someone can be forced to create a website where they have to write opinions that they don't agree with. What do you think about that case?
Sure. Once again, nothing controversial here. 303 Creative. This was a case, this was a pre-enforcement challenge to a Colorado statute. The plaintiff is a graphic designer who wanted to go into the business of making wedding websites and custom wedding websites. And the plaintiff sued Colorado saying that I'm concerned that you will force me to, against my convictions, my religious convictions, to create same-sex wedding websites. That's something that I have a First Amendment right to do, she asserted, both a First Amendment free speech right and a First Amendment free exercise right, which is interesting. The court in Colorado said in response, we absolutely can do that. This is a discrimination provision, and what you are doing is discriminating against gay people, and you do not have a right, you do not have a First Amendment right to discriminate against gay people. And that's what you are effectively doing by declining to offer same-sex wedding websites. You don't have to offer any websites to anyone, but if you do, you have to offer them to everybody without regard to the particular characteristics that Colorado law, anti-discrimination law, protected. And the court actually, interestingly enough, granted cert only to decide the free speech issue and did not wish to opine on the free exercise issue, which I'll get into for a second. And the court basically says that, yes, indeed, the wedding website designer has that right. She has, wedding websites, custom wedding websites, when you design one of those, that is pure speech. And when Colorado says that Lori Smith is compelled to provide those wedding websites against her beliefs, that is a First Amendment violation. The court does that by a 6-3 vote. And I think it's interesting, but in dissent, Justice Sotomayor says, well, wait a second, not so fast. You know, we have discrimination law, and it is a general principle of law. There are cases where, for example, companies have challenged Title VII anti-discrimination protections and said, Well, I have a right to associate and have in my firm, whoever I want, and I have an associational, if I have a First Amendment interest, to do that, notwithstanding anti-discrimination law. That is my sincere belief. And the court has said, in some cases in the 80s, they said, no, you don't have a right to do that. The discrimination laws are something that are generally applicable laws regulating conduct, and the fact that an anti-discrimination law may sideswipe your speech, that is, in a particular case, you may think you have a sincere belief that you wish to discriminate, that's not what the First Amendment does, because that's a generally applicable law, and that's a regulation of conduct, and that's what Justice Sotomayor says in her dissent. And Justice Gorsuch says, well, wait a second, it's not really conduct that's being regulated here, because it was stipulated in the case that Lori Smith was willing to sell wedding websites to anyone of whatever sexual orientation. It was about the content of the speech that she was being compelled to provide. It was not about the status of the individuals that she was serving. And the court suggests that it might be a very different case if, for example, a supplier of chairs, let's say, rental chairs said, well, I don't want to provide this to people who are gay. And the court suggests that that might be different, that that might be a regulation of conduct, even if that person has a very sincere, deep-seated belief that supplying chairs to gay people is in fact contrary to their sincere religious beliefs. And I think it's a very interesting case. And the thing that I wanted to focus on was this distinction that the court draws, and very much I think the case rests on, between discrimination on the basis of status and discrimination on the basis of conduct. Because it's a good example where an area of law implicates a kind of distinction that appears in a lot of other areas of the law, and the areas are not kind of talking to each other very much, because this distinction between status and conduct is one that appears in a lot of the court's cases. And the one that I thought is interesting to think about is the case of Lawrence versus Texas, which was a case the Supreme Court decided in 2003 that said that there is a substantive due process right to engage in sodomy. That is, a state cannot criminalize sodomy consistent with substantive due process principles. And one of the things that the court says, and one of the bases for that decision, is the court said that to criminalize sodomy is to discriminate against gay people, that it is effectively the same thing, even though there's not necessarily a one-to-one correlation between the particular status and the particular conduct. And I just point to another example, and these comparisons are not made in the opinion, that another area of First Amendment doctrine, that is free exercise doctrine. In recent years, the court's free exercise doctrine has focused, and starting in 2017 with a case called Trinity Lutheran, has focused on the distinction between discrimination on the basis of religious status, that is, being a church, being a religious person, a religiously minded person, versus discrimination on the basis of the use to which funds may be put. Building a pew, building a church, that is a use of funds and not discrimination necessarily, or so the court said in some cases, in the starting in 2017 and beyond, and that's different from discrimination on the basis of status. That's a distinction and here in 303 Creative, the court is pretty narrowly construing what discrimination on the basis of status is. And I think that's very interesting to see how that might bleed into or affect other areas of law. I also think that one oddity about this opinion, normally the court, I think, wants to take cases where it expects that the decision will have broadly resolve and settle a legal issue. And I think there's very little likelihood that this opinion actually does that. The opinion again and again stresses the stipulation that Colorado made in the case. And the stipulation that Colorado made was that the plaintiff's conduct was expressive, in fact. And the court, again and again, in response to the dissent's charge, well, no, this is just conduct. And says, no, well, Colorado stipulated this. They gave this away a long time ago. So, and I think this is only the beginning of the litigation in this area, because we are going to have, in future cases, debates over whether particular kinds of conduct that people are seeking an exemption for under generally applicable discrimination statutes is in fact expressive. What about making wedding cakes? Is that expressive? Providing wedding chairs, is that expressive? In Hurley in 2000, the case in 2000, the court said that conducting a St. Patrick's Day parade was expressive. You could not, you were entitled to an exemption from a generally applicable discrimination law in view of the expressive interest in conducting a St. Patrick's Day parade. So that's one data point. On the other hand, in this case called Rumsfeld versus Fair, decided in 2006, the court seemed to suggest that the federal government could compel law schools based on an anti-discrimination law, a law that prevented discrimination against military recruiters, could compel a law school to have military recruiters on campus. So hosting military recruiters, not expressive, okay. And I think that's what we're gonna, this is only the beginning of litigation over whether various kinds of services provided are or are not expressive, because no one in the future case is going to make Colorado's mistake of stipulating that the conduct in question is expressive, and that will open up a new vista of litigation in this area, I think.
So Henry had mentioned Lawrence versus Texas. In a different context, it's worth reading Justice Thomas's dissent in that opinion. It won't take you nearly as long, it's two paragraphs long. But it really brings you back to what we do here as in this organization. It said something like, this law is uncommonly silly, and had I been in the legislature, I wouldn't have voted for it. But I'm not in the legislature, I'm a justice. And so it really kind of lays out the separation of powers in just two or three sentences. And so it's a much quicker read than affirmative action, for sure.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Thoughts on 303?
So I'll make just a couple of quick points, and Henry already touched on most of these, but I do think this pre-enforcement posture of this case is very important and something that has caused some misapprehension, misrepresentation in some of the news stories that have come out after the case. I'm sure many of you may have seen some of the news stories alleging misconduct by the ADF attorneys, the Alliance Defending Freedom attorneys who represented Lori Smith, saying they misrepresented a fact to the court that the person who alleged asked Lori Smith to create one of these wedding websites may in fact not have existed. A reporter called someone. They said they never called Lori Smith or her wedding website business. Those allegations of misconduct, they're just nonsense, particularly because in this pre-enforcement posture, the court is dealing with stipulated facts. So everyone agreed on the factual circumstances that the court was resolving in this case. And to your point, Henry, about whether this case will actually resolve issues going forward. You know, one of the problems I think you often encounter with pre-enforcement challenge cases, it does give things sort of this ephemeral quality. You're resolving things sort of in the abstract, maybe not as quite as concrete as if there are actually a fully developed record, actual post-enforcement cases coming before the court. So that's one thing to keep in mind. Then you also mentioned the cake baker, the Masterpiece Cake Shop case. And of course, that was one of the central issues in Masterpiece Cake Shop, was baking a cake expressive conduct? Could that be protected by the First Amendment? And so this case much more clearly teed up the First Amendment, the expressive conduct issue. As Henry mentioned, Colorado, the party stipulated that this was expressive conduct. But to Henry's point about this just being the beginning of the litigation, keep in mind, Jack Phillips, even though he won his case at the Supreme Court, he's back in Colorado State Court again. A transgender activist called his cake shop, asked him to bake a cake celebrating a gender transition. Jack Phillips said he couldn't do that. That violated his deeply held religious beliefs. And so he's back in front of back in the Colorado court system now, essentially litigating litigating many of the same issues that were previously raised in these types of cases. So I do think this is just the beginning of a very long discussion, a very long series of litigation tactics that we'll see in this area.
Can I just make one other point? I thought also that to compare, I think it's interesting to compare Justice Sotomayor's dissent, her approach in this case, compared to the affirmative action case, as Zach mentioned. I mean, there are at least two ways to write a dissent. One way is you can say, the sky is falling and get out your helmets, everyone, because the world has ended as a result of the majority's opinion. And the other way to write a dissent is to say, the majority's opinion, there's a ways around it. The majority's opinion is wrong, but ultimately it's not that big a deal because we can get around the majority's opinion in various ways, such as the ways that Justice Sotomayor hinted at in her dissent in the affirmative action cases. Her opinion in the 303 Creative case is more of the sky is falling vintage. Justice Sotomayor does not really, highlight the distinction that the majority attempts to draw between status and use, and says that no, the majority has effectively sanctioned status-based discrimination and said that you get a First Amendment exemption for that. And I think it'll be interesting to see whether future litigants try to use Justice Sotomayor's dire predictions about the implications of the majority's ruling in ways that she probably wouldn't like. Probably illustrates the maxim, which I think is a correct one, that the predictions of the dissenting opinion are not necessarily the best indication of how to read the majority opinion.
So Zach, let me go to you on Biden versus Nebraska, another case that was decided in that last week. I think it's another June 30th case. So there, it's a plan to forgive $430 billion worth of student debt. Can you talk about that decision?
Sure. Again, not a controversial decision at all. But this was another 6-3 decision. And there are actually, let me take a step back. There are actually two decisions involving the Biden administration's plan to cancel student loans. So the first decision we'll talk about is one that was brought by two individuals who were claiming that they didn't receive as many benefits as they should have received under the student debt cancellation because the Biden administration didn't follow certain notice and comment negotiated rulemaking procedures that these plaintiffs thought the Biden administration should have followed. Justice Samuel Alito, in this Department of Education versus Brown decision, actually wrote for a unanimous court saying that these two individuals did not have standing or the legal ability to challenge the Biden administration's student loan debt cancellation plan. And he went through this typical standing factors, talking about the necessity for concrete injury, the necessity for traceability back to the government's actions, and then also redressability. And while Justice Alito said he thought that these plaintiffs failed on all three respects in terms of standing, that the traceability issue was the most significant issue facing them. And one of the reasons I think Justice Alito wrote the decision this way is because the arguments that these plaintiffs were advancing were very difficult arguments for them to advance. They were walking a high wire act in some respects. Because on the one hand, they were saying, we didn't receive as much benefit as we should have received by the Biden administration because they didn't engage in notice and comment rulemaking. We didn't have an opportunity to participate in the process. But on the other hand, we don't think the Biden administration has the legal authority to take this action. And so it was kind of an inherent tension between these two arguments. But at the end of the day, all of the justices agreed that neither one of these plaintiffs had the legal ability to challenge this action. So this leads us to the next case, Biden versus Nebraska. This case was where six states actually came together and challenged this same debt forgiveness scheme that the Biden administration advanced. Now, this ended up being a 6-3 decision where Chief Justice Roberts again wrote for the majority, and again, the three liberal-leaning justices dissented from that decision. But again, standing was one of the big issues that had to be confronted in this case, because even though states were challenging the action instead of individuals, the Biden administration said that the states weren't actually harmed by their action, that they couldn't bring this legal challenge? Well, one of the things that Chief Justice Roberts talks about in the opinion is why these states have standing. And the way he said the states have standing is that Missouri has a loan servicing agency, MOHELA is the acronym for it. And it's a public corporation that effectively acts as an arm of the state. And so because it stands to lose, I think somewhere in the neighborhood of $44 million in servicing fees as a result of this loan forgiveness plan, the state of Missouri would have standing to challenge this action. And it's long held case law that so long as one plaintiff has standing, that's good enough for the court and they'll move forward to the merits. And so then on the merits, the justices found, of course, that the Biden administration didn't have the authority to take this very expansive action, which, as the judge mentioned, would purport to forgive about $430 billion in student loan debt. Essentially, about 98% of borrowers, federal student loan borrowers, would be impacted by the Biden administration's plan. About half of those, around 20 million or so, would have their debt completely forgiven under this plan. A little more than half of those borrowers, somewhere around 23 million, would have their debt reduced by more than half. So this is clearly a very comprehensive, very broad plan that the Biden administration implemented. Now, the legal justification that the administration pointed to for enacting this plan was something called the HEROES Act. The HEROES Act was implemented in the wake of September 11th, 2001, that essentially would give the Secretary of Education very limited authority to waive or modify, and that's the key language in this case, that waive or modify language, to waive or modify student loan debt repayment in the wake of certain military actions or certain federal emergencies. And so, what the Biden administration said is the waive or modify language gave the Secretary of Education very broad power, much more broad power to act than if the statute said waive a loan or modify a loan. But when read in conjunction, waive or modify gave the executive branch very, very broad power. Now, of course, the Chief Justice and the majority of justices, they weren't buying this argument. They said that waive or modify does give the Secretary of Education some limited authority in some limited circumstances to do just that, waive or modify certain debt repayments or the terms of certain debt repayments. They said what it does not give the Secretary the authority to do is, quote, rewrite the statute from the ground up. And yet that's exactly what they said the Secretary of Education was purporting to do. Now, one of the interesting things about the Chief Justice's majority opinion is that he cited to the court's previous opinion in West Virginia versus EPA. Now, you may remember West Virginia versus EPA was the decision where the court really put forward very comprehensively for the first time the major questions doctrine. The court said this is a doctrine that's been around for many, many years, but they clearly articulated it in the West Virginia versus EPA. And because of the broad scope of the Biden administration's actions, because of the vast economic consequences of its actions, the Chief Justice said, you know, this certainly falls within the realm of the major questions doctrine, that if Congress had intended to give the Secretary of Education this broad authority, it would have clearly said so, and they didn't clearly say so. So this action is not appropriate. Now, going back quickly before I talk about the dissents in this case, is we talked about some of the pointed language that the justices have pointed at each other this term, particularly in their opinions. And the Chief Justice, in particular in this case, really seems to take issue with some of that very pointed language. The dissent in this case, Justice Kagan, she had some very sharp criticism for the court, for the justices. She essentially accused them of not being good textualists, of saying they trot out the major questions doctrine to get around the plain meaning of a statute whenever they don't like what it says. And so he said, it's become a disturbing practice from some opinions to essentially question the legitimacy of the court whenever the majority opinion issues a decision they don't like. He says that's very dangerous. It's become a very unfortunate byproduct of some of the recent dissenting opinions. And so he really pushes back, in some sense, against some of that very pointed language. Now, of course, Justice Kagan, she takes issue with the majority's approach, again, basically tries in some sense to relitigate the holding in West Virginia versus EPA, the idea of the major questions doctrine. And I suspect that is one of the reasons you saw Justice Amy Coney Barrett issuing a separate concurring opinion in this case, where essentially her entire concurring opinion deals with this issue of the major questions doctrine, what exactly it is, where its origin came from, the fact that this is not a new doctrine that the court is dealing with, it's been around for many, many years, its proper role in constitutional interpretation, and that just because the court is applying a canon like the major questions doctrine doesn't mean that they are not being textualist or that they are not following the law in certain circumstances, and that in fact canons of construction or substantive canons can help the justices reach the best reading of the text. And so that was a very interesting back and forth that we saw, and again, a continuation of some of the very pointed language that the justices have leveled at each other.
Zach, do you think that these dissents that they're writing and this kind of language is maybe to set things up for the future in case they have an opportunity in the future to write in the majority and then they can pull from their dissent? Or what is it? Is it just they're getting more acerbic with age? What's happening?
It's hard to say. I've seen some commentators say that the justices today have adopted a much more informal, a much more accessible writing style, and sometimes it's much easier to either slip into much harsher language or for language to be read in a much harsher light than kind of the formal academic legal writing that the court has engaged in the past. And I don't know that the pointed language is necessarily due solely to ideological differences, because one of the sharpest exchange this term actually took place between Justice Sotomayor and Justice Kagan when they were on opposite sides of a case in a case involving the Andy Warhol Foundation and the fair use of one of Andy Warhol's images. He'd used a photograph. Yes, it was. It was. One of the prints. And Justice Sotomayor was in the majority in that case. And Justice Kagan, at the outset of her dissent, just absolutely savaged in a very personal, very pointed way Justice Sotomayor, and essentially encouraged readers, you know, don't take the majority opinion at face value. I encourage everyone to dig deeper, look at the underlying sources, the underlying cases for yourselves, and draw your own conclusions.
Sounds like good advice for a law school.
It does. It's very good advice. I encourage everyone to take it. I don't often say that about Justice Kagan's opinions. This is something we're seeing across the board, and it's not necessarily ideologically driven.
Got it. Henry, any thoughts on this particular opinion? I think Zach really covered it, but...
Sure. Yeah, I certainly agree with that. I mean, just a couple thoughts. I mean, I think this really, this opinion, you know, Zach talked about the major questions doctrine, and this is the doctrine that, look, if you're going to interpret the agency, a federal agency, to have big types of authority, we want to make sure that Congress has deliberately and clearly conferred that authority. And I think this cements the role even further, together with the last term's decision in West Virginia versus EPA, of the major questions doctrine as not being really a device for resolving statutory ambiguity. I mean, there would be one way to think about that, say, like, well, if there's two different ways to read a statute, we put our thumb on the scale in favor of the one that provides the agency with less sweeping authority. It's really a way of, it's really a canon of specificity, I think, because it applies in circumstances where there may be a facially broad and unqualified delegation of authority that the agency has had, in this case, the authority to waive or modify various provisions of the Higher Education Act, which impose restrictions on the power of the agency to cancel debt and deal with debt and the like. And the court says, well, you know, that may be broad and unqualified, but we're not going to run forward to, absent some more specific language, really, to construe that to give the agency that authority. And it's interesting to think about what would have happened if the court went the other way. And what, you know, Robert's opinion, the chief's opinion does not discuss delegation concerns about what would happen. But think about this. I mean, Justice Kagan in her dissent is basically saying that the secretary can rip up the Higher Education Act in any particular case and establish whatever requirements the secretary would like for any given loan program. How is that not an unlawful delegation of power? Basically, the ability to repeal and then enact a new statute in its place. Now look, there are cases where, in, you know, the Marshall Field case from 1892, where the court has recognized broad authority to waive certain provisions of law, though I don't know of any case that says that upholds a delegation that says an agency can waive provisions and then replace them with whatever provisions the agency would like on its own. And it's interesting that the chief doesn't explicitly talk about that problem. But I do think that part of what the major questions doctrine is getting at is, as Justice Barrett outlined in her concurrence to some degree, that it is a substantive canon that is trying to take care of this potential delegation problem. In other words, you know, if the alternative is an unconstitutional delegation, we're not going to run forward to read a statute to do something like that. And I also did think that Justice Barrett's concurrence was interesting. I think Justice Barrett is emerging as probably one of the best writers on the court, and also one of the more sort of academically minded members of the court. She's definitely interested in you know, as a former professor, she's interested in theoretical issues. Mm-hmm. And I was pleased to see that she's sort of begun to you know, write almost Justice Thomas style concurrences with her thoughts on various areas, because I think that can add a lot to our understanding of the law, and her insights, I think, are very, very interesting. So I hope she keeps doing that. I also hope that she votes to grant cert in more cases instead of just writing random concurrences in other cases. But maybe that's a parochial interest on my part. So
that's great. So before we get to our last case, I do want to draw everyone's attention to some criminal cases that are out there. We rarely talk about criminal cases at these panels, but there are a few that are somewhat concerning. One of them is Counterman versus Colorado. It's worth a read. It is basically a opinion by the Supreme Court that says that when written threats are made in the criminal context, that the analysis as to whether it's a threat is to look at the subjective opinion of the defendant, of the person making the threat. Keep in mind that when we trial judges get these cases, most of these defendants are mentally ill. I don't know how prosecutors are going to be able to prove that mentally ill defendants knew that what they were saying were threatening. So it's worth a read on that case. There's Smith versus United States, which is a case that was tried to verdict. The venue was wrong. Supreme Court said it's not a double jeopardy violation to try that case again in the proper
venue.
That
one's actually out of the Northern District of Florida.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. That's a pretty rough case. And then Samia versus United States is one that seems to really start gutting the Bruton Doctrine, which is basically use of a non-testifying co-defendant's statement at trial. Basically, it says you can insulate the statement by removing the co-defendant's name and just using words like him or her and insulating it that way. So pretty interesting cases.
One other criminal law case I'll just quickly mention is the Simonelli case that came out this term as well, where basically the court rejected the right to control theory of honest services fraud that many U.S. attorneys' offices have used in the past to secure wire fraud convictions. And so it'll be interesting to see how that affects many federal prosecutions going forward as well.
Very true. So because everyone loves dormant commerce clause, I promised Henry that we would end with National Pork Producers versus Ross. And Henry, why don't you take
that
one?
Sure, yeah. Well, I mean, I think it is interesting.
Yes.
Maybe I'm the only one. I can talk about something else if you want. But look, I think this is an interesting case. This was a case where California basically said that any pork imported into California has to, you know, you have to treat pigs in certain ways. They have to you know, they have to sleep on silk pillows or something at night. You have to treat your pigs in a certain way. And this was very consequential because California basically imports all of its pork. Maybe not 100%, but almost all of its pork. And so basically this was just a way of California, as a practical matter, to regulate the nationwide pork market. Nothing less than regulating the nationwide pork market, because California is such a big, important market that, as a practical matter, particularly if you have vertically integrated producers and distributors, that as a practical matter, if you want to be in this business, you're gonna have to sell to the California market. And so there was a very vigorous challenge to this, and saying, like, look, you know, where does California get off, you know, basically telling other states how they can regulate their own producer, effectively saying that, you know, this is the minimum, nationwide minimum. We're California, and we know how pork should be produced better than any of the other states. And I think the court's reaction to this was very interesting. I mean, you know, Justice Gorsuch and a decided majority of the court says, we're not worried about this. And it's a very interesting Justice Gorsuch's reaction in particular, which, you know, he writes this plurality that throws a lot of shade on the dormant Commerce Clause doctrine generally. Clearly Justice Gorsuch is himself a great dormant Commerce Clause skeptic. I mean, the dormant Commerce Clause doctrine basically says that even absent a particular legislative act by Congress, we interpret the Constitution to have an implicit negative command that sometimes state regulation can be so interfering with interstate commerce that we think that the courts have authority to strike those regulations down. even in the face sometimes of explicit constitutional commands to the contrary. One of my favorite lines in this regard, Judge Easterbrook has an opinion about the 21st Amendment. The 21st Amendment says, one of the things the 21st Amendment says is that states have authority to regulate liquor. The importation of liquor into a state in violation of its own laws is prohibited. That is in the 21st Amendment. And the court has said, notwithstanding that language, the Dormant Commerce Clause can actually override that. So, you know, the 21st Amendment can be subordinated to the non-textual Dormant Commerce Clause even in some circumstances, which is kind of remarkable. And it's very interesting because the court, you know, has this passage, which only three justices sign on to, casting a lot of shade on the balancing tests that may obtain under the Dormant Commerce Clause sometimes, and says, how do you balance things? You know, and cites a Justice Scalia opinion that famously said, how do you figure out whether a rock is longer, or a line is longer than a rock is heavy? Which is nothing less, I think, than a general indictment of the administrability of basically all balancing tests, all balancing. And, you know, notwithstanding that, you know, basically a solid majority of the court says, no, balancing is just fine in this context. We just happen to think that the plaintiff's allegations in this case did not allege sufficiently that there was a sufficient negative impact on interstate commerce, even though California was basically regulating the entire nationwide pork market. So it's kind of a very narrow construction of the Dormant Commerce Clause, and I think it illustrates that this is not the Rehnquist court. This is not a pro-business court. Justices Gorsuch and Thomas in particular, they're not as concerned as the Rehnquist court was with being pro-business, and they're not as concerned with negative consequences of their decisions if they think the law requires a particular result.
That line and rock question sounds like something Danny Boggs should have on his clerk quiz, which my nephew, who's here somewhere, had to take. So, but. Zach, any thoughts on that case?
Yeah, just a couple of quick thoughts, very quick thoughts, is I think you are right, Henry. You know, this certainly is not a court that looks at business, being pro-business or anti-business. For instance, the Mallory decision dealing with personal jurisdiction as well, I think many corporations, many business groups were against that decision, which gives states very broad leeway, very broad authority to subject even out-of-state corporations to personal jurisdiction within their states. And then also to your point, Henry, about justice Justice Gorsuch in particular, adhering to his view of the law, regardless of the consequences. We obviously saw that play out several years ago with the McGirt decision, where he found half the state of Oklahoma to suddenly be an Indian reservation that was never disestablished. The negative collateral consequences from that decision are still very much alive in the state of Oklahoma today. In fact, the 10th Circuit just had an opinion come out recently where they found that the city of Tulsa, in many instances, can't even issue municipal traffic citations to violators there. And so, we are seeing many areas of law affected, I think, by that approach. Some areas of law, particularly Indian law, as a result of that, are somewhat in flux at the court right now because of that. But it will be very interesting to see how that develops in the future.
I'm a different kind of Indian. You know, you kind of leaned to me when you said Indian law.
No. I was thinking criminal law. Yeah. Criminal law.
One of the interesting things also on pork producers is the 5-4 makeup was quite different than the 6-3 in the other three cases that we've talked about too. It wasn't your normal split.
Sure, and we even have Justice Jackson joining the chief, Kavanaugh and Alito, the three sort of consequentialist conservatives in dissent, saying, you know, California, this looks like a complaint states a dormant commerce clause claim to me. California's regulating the whole nationwide pork market. So I thought that was interesting that Justice Jackson joined that opinion. But then you have Justice Kagan and Justice Sotomayor writing separately and saying, well, we're not going to say that you can't balance in this area, but we think that California can do this and that the complaint needs to be dismissed. That's another interesting thing is that the procedural posture is interesting because, I mean, normally it's pretty hard to get. I would have thought it would be pretty hard to get a complaint dismissed on the basis of allegations that seem to be kind of fact specific, what the consequences of a particular regulation are on the market. I would have thought that it would have been pretty straightforward to allege facts that construed in the light most favorable to the plaintiff to do that. And so the court says that no, they didn't do that. Maybe they wrote a bad complaint. I don't know. But I thought that was pretty interesting. And again, I think it illustrates that the court was pretty skeptical of the Dormant Commerce Clause, at least that majority.
So folks, there's a whole number of other cases. There are voting rights cases, independent state legislature doctrine, tribal rights cases. Obviously, we can't get to all of them, but we're only about 5 or 6 minutes away from lunch. So if there are any questions out there, we're happy to take them. And then Lisa, I don't know if Hannah wants to give everyone some instructions on how lunch is going to work, but she can work her way up here whenever. So. Anyone have a question at all? I will tell you, young lawyers, that back in the day, before we had conferences like this, you'd have to pay about $1,000 an hour to be able to spend this kind of time with people like this. So definitely ask your questions if you have them. If you don't have questions, after the seminar, shake some hands, make sure you get to know these guys and many of the other people in the room. I when I was starting out, you couldn't go to a conference where Justice Sasso sitting 3 feet away from you, or Justice Lawson sitting just right across, or these lawyers of this quality are just here available to you. So definitely, you really avail yourself of that opportunity.
Yeah. I just had a quick question about the 303 case and your discussion regarding that. Obviously, reading Roberts' majority opinion talks about a bunch of the seminal cases you would expect, Barnett and Hurley for compelled speech, and also Skokie and Phelps regarding the inability to enforce silence even in odious speech. And when you read that, it seems just painfully obvious the way that the case should end up is the way that it did, but it seems like the dissent is almost nonsensical given that light. Do you think that this is going to be indicative of three dissenting justices in the future just wholly abandoning those principles espoused in Barnett, Hurley, Skokie, and Phelps, or is it going to be a content based upon the nature of the speech that they may themselves object to, that they're just going to selectively ignore those cases for this particular analysis, but then they may be willing to consider it in different circumstances?
So Zach, I'm going to let you handle that because I don't know if a district court judge should talk about potentially a Supreme Court dissent being nonsensical.
Sure. Yeah. Well, I'm curious to hear your thoughts on it too, Henry, but my sense of it is, this goes back to what Henry was talking about earlier, that I think a lot of the debate in this area particularly is going to go against this speech versus conduct area, right? If you're saying something, that's clearly speech. When you get into these other areas like baking a cake, making a website, is the court going to find that to be expressive conduct, or are they going to decide that that is, action similar to providing a hotel room, similar to providing goods and other services to individuals where the state has a much freer hand to regulate? And so I think that will, at least in my view, that will be where a lot of the future disputes and battles will be fought.
Sure. Well, I mean, I wouldn't go so far as to call the dissent nonsensical. I mean, I do think there's a real debate there. There's a reason why it was a Supreme Court case, and there were so many briefs on both sides. And look, I think that there is this difficult line to draw between when you're regulating conduct and regulating speech, and that becomes particularly pointed when you're talking about anti-discrimination regulation. And look, I mean, this is hard because there are any number of... This is a problem in First Amendment doctrine, because sometimes when the court is faced with generally applicable laws, a good example is the O'Brien case, where that case, involved a generally applicable law that in application was being applied to burning a draft card, and the court said, well. You can have any number of expressive kinds of conduct, but if it's generally applicable law, we're not going to lightly say that the state can't do that or assume that the state, in establishing that kind of general regulation, is suppressing speech. I mean, you can think about fraud laws, securities disclosure laws. There are any number of kinds of laws that may have impacts on speech in some respects, and you have to reconcile that with the compelled speech cases. And so I do think there's a debate there. As I said, I think ultimately, the majority seems to even agree that if what you had was, I think they agree. I mean, it's not 100% clear, but I think they agree that if you had status-based discrimination, I don't know, the state could do that actually. And so we have to draw these fine distinctions, and that's a real debate, I think.
Just close it up with your question.
I'm going to just be a conduit here for my cripple friend. Sorry, I'm the GIMP over here. It's kind of a follow-up question in the same vein, which is if this sort of question of what constitutes expressive conduct is going to just continue to proliferate in light of the court's ruling, and I think it already has, in the wake of Masterpiece Cake Shop, it just invited more confusion and more questions. Did the court do us a disservice not to grant cert on the religious liberty question? Because for me, I look at all of these objections from vendors to providing the services being requested, and they're all fundamentally religious. And so I think the court would, be able to more squarely address the issues and would actually be able to resolve them, as you were alluding to, Henry, if they actually just address the heart of the matter, which is there some sort of exemption for a religious objector?
I think that's a great point. I mean, and I don't know why they didn't grant cert on the religious liberty aspect of things. I suspect it's because there is a doctrine that exists in the religious liberty context that grows up out of this case called Employment Division versus Smith, which said that if you have a generally applicable and neutral law, which the court has in subsequent cases construed pretty narrowly, but if you have such a law, then there isn't a free exercise problem, actually. The states can do that, actually, through generally applicable and neutral laws. And I think that they wanted to avoid having to deal with the question whether that doctrine was viable today, which it may not be, actually, so they could have overruled that, but I just think that was a complicating feature. They just wanted to focus on whether this expressive conduct, and it was expressive, stipulated in the facts, will decide whether that entitles you to an exemption. I think that they did that. But one interesting thing, you mentioned courts deciding what's expressive in future cases. In the religious liberty context, the courts basically don't look at whether your religious belief is sincere at all. This threshold question, whether it is in fact a religious belief, and a sincere religious belief, is one the court has not touched with a 10-foot
pole. What about in Wisconsin v. Yoder, when the court looked directly at that sort of thing for the Amish?
Well, but Yoder was a case where ultimately they said, well, there might be a, you know, some limit in a future case, but ultimately there, they even said, we're not going to question the sincerity of the religious belief there. There might be, I can't remember the exact phrasing the court uses, but it says something like, there could be such, you know, a religious belief that's so odd that could lead us to question that, but especially in subsequent cases, and I'd point to the Hobby Lobby case as Exhibit A, where the court says, like, we're not going to look at this. And so, but they do very much look in the free speech context at whether particular conduct is expressive. And we have seen cases where the court has said, no, we just think this is conduct. You don't have an expressive interest. They seem to be more willing in those contexts to second guess whether something is expressive, which is an interesting, you know, can judges do that? Can judges figure out whether something is expressive? Can they figure out that better than whether a religious belief is sincere? I don't know. I mean, so I think that's very interesting, that comparison.
So folks, if you could give Henry and Zach a hand, they're wonderful as always.